Down. We'd like to start.
All right. Mic works. Yeah, it seems like that. Yeah, hello, good morning. Welcome to our talk. My name is Günther Deschner. I work for Red Hat and Samba for a long, long time. This is my colleague Sachin Prabhu. We have been giving a very similar talk about multi-channel and the implementation in Samba last year. So in case you're more interested in the fancy new, really completely new stuff Andreas is talking about, then maybe this is the last chance to run over to the other room. So we will mostly give an update, kind of show you the delta, what has happened between last year's work and the update that we currently can provide. So first of all, I will briefly dive a little bit into what actually this whole motivation for this work has been, what the products that Sachin, me, and others at Red Hat are working for, what our offering in that particular area are. And after that, I will briefly dive into the multi-channel feature itself to explain what it's all about and why it is so important for Samba to really finally catch up with that and to implement it and to provide it to our users. Then I will elaborate a little bit more about the oplock and lease break failures, so some really technical important aspects that we had been challenging ourselves with, and Sachin can provide some updates there. He was spending more time on this last year than I had. And then finally, we want to also elaborate a little bit on the difficulties that we have with testing multi-channel, because it is a setup with really many parties and complex scenarios. And doing this in an automated fashion, of course, has its challenges. So we will talk about this a little bit. And then finally, we are talking about clustering here, and CTDB has not really been aware of dealing with multi-channel. So we have a lot of loose ends ending up in this last component, CTDB being then kind of a manager for coordinating multi-channel failover, these sorts of things. So definitely we'll talk about this a little bit more. Yeah, and then question and answers. So at any time, feel free to interrupt if you have any questions. Yeah, otherwise I'll repeat the question. All right. So Sachin and me, we work on a product called Red Hat Cluster Storage, which is an offering independent of the underlying operating system. So that's a layer product on top of RHEL 6 and on RHEL 7, soon also probably on RHEL 8, we're going to see that. And it provides basically a polished version of the cluster file system with various accessor protocols on top of it, NFS, of course, but of course also SMB, which is the component we are in charge of and we are taking care of. CTDB is used as the HA component, so that it controls the activity and the monitoring of the services like Samba, Winbind, and other things. And also it makes sure that IP addresses are properly being monitored and held up and migrated to other cluster nodes, these sorts of things. So it's all a well-integrated solution under that name ArcGIS. On the Samba side of things, there has been a module created a long time ago already called VFS ClusterFS, which uses an accessor library in order to access the cluster storage directly. So it's not expecting an underlying mounted file system. You still have, of course, the ability as well. So you can just whatever mount a cluster volume on your nodes using a Fuse module, and then re-export it to Samba as if it would be a local file system. So just a very classic approach. The VFS cluster approach, the first module I was mentioning, has some advantages. It allows asynchronous I/O and many other optimized ways in order to access the storage, while the Fuse approach lacks these optimizations. We were now coming up with an idea to provide some small additions if you are using a Fuse mount and want to re-export it using Samba. To provide the VFS get real file name call. If you have been attending Jeremy's talk yesterday, the get real file name interface is a really important speed up improvement in order to make access two files and to make all these complex case folding mechanisms of case insensitive file names much more faster. So an implementation of that get real file name call is something we can provide because cluster is exposing an extended attribute, which then that module can pick up and so forth. So we will summarize some of these specific properties for using Fuse and cluster under one module in the future. It has been just released recently with Samba 4.9. It's not yet in the ArcGIS products. This is about to happen in the future, I guess. Right now we ship with the current ArcGIS version 3.4.4. Samba 4.8.5. Multi-channel in that Samba release is present and can be used in theory, but it, from a whatever product point of view, it's still to be considered a tech preview feature. So there are some instructions available on the Red Hat websites that tell you how you can currently use it without really putting yourself into danger. But it comes with a couple of limitations. So this is, of course, the motivation why we want to look at multi-channel again and finish it. So multi-channel, you most probably are familiar with it and used it maybe on standalone Samba machines. It has been a feature implemented since quite a while. Samba SMB multi-channel per se is a very, very important performance and reliability feature available with the SMB3 protocol. SMB protocol since Windows 2012. Its main purpose is to maximize throughput, does that by aggregating multiple TCP connections on a machine in order to increase the throughput. It does that with all kind of different combinations. It can use RDMA, of course, if RDMA devices are available. RDMA transport is accessible. But you can also use a feature called receive side scaling, which is the ability of a machine to offload the processing of the network traffic to multiple CPU cores on a machine. So you can have just one NIC on the client and on the server, but you can still have multiple TCP connections in between them, and then the CPU can then use all its cores in order to process the throughput instead of for just one. There's also a feature called NIC teaming, which allows you to put more NICs together. So all kinds of different setups. The big advantage, of course, when you consider you don't have just one TCP connection at the SMB layer, but multiple, is of course fault tolerance. When one of these connections is just failing, you still have many other connections between client and server that you can use. Then finally, if you think about all these aspects, it would be a nightmare to manually set that up. And the really cool thing about multi-channel, the way it is implemented in Windows, is it's completely automated. It has a automatic configuration. You don't need to consider anything. You can enable or disable some of its properties. You can monitor it also. There are some nice PowerShell commandlets for these things. But you don't need to artificially define what you actually want to achieve. So the operating system is really clever, choosing the right options to you and for you, and just transparently enables it once all these prerequisites are met, like client and server need to obviously talk the SMB3 protocol, and there need to be matching interfaces and some interfaces that provide some properties that allow multi-channel to be activated. So this is just one of the use cases. You can imagine where you have just a single NIC, but in this case it would be a NIC using receive side scaling, so it can build up not only one TCP connection between client and server, but actually four. That is a common scenario. Another one would be to have multiple NICs, so instead of just having 1 gigabit Ethernet between client and server, you could aggregate the throughput to 2 gigabit using the same SMB session and just TCP connects in between them. So there are many other examples. I don't really want to elaborate on all of these. Of course, the level of throughput, the level of fault tolerance, that all differs on what kind of setup you have chosen, or the operating system has basically chosen for you. Of course, using multiple NICs with RDMA, as you see on this list from Microsoft's documentation, gives you the maximum throughput. So that is considered to be the strongest setup. Right. As I mentioned, multi-channel per se has been implemented and present and been worked on already with the release of SMB3, but the first real official implementation came with Samba 4.4 already 3 years ago. The only thing you actually need to do in order to activate it is to set one configuration option called server multi-channel support equals yes. That's all it actually takes. The Samba server then will then ask the kernel for device properties in order to communicate these properties to the client so that client and server can kind of agree on which interfaces to use for multi-channel and to what kind of channels, number of channels and so forth to set up. Of course, you can also override these things. There are some manual parametric options, I believe it was, that you can use there. The way Samba works with a main SMBD process, which is then forking off SMBDs for all its connected clients, requires that a technology is used in order to aggregate all these different TCP connections in just one SMBD. And in Samba, a technology called FD passing is used in order to do that, which allows to pass over an FD and a network socket over to one SMBD, so that just one SMBD is then able to communicate with all the existing channels that have been set up. So this FD passing, you were going to see this in other slides as well. This is on the server side, it's implemented and ready and working, but it was giving us really a hard time, and it's still really an issue we need to work on when it comes to testing, because it's something hard to abstract. So this implementation is there. It's still considered to be experimental, so by default, it's still turned off, so you need to manually enable it if you want to run it. And mainly, it's still that case because there are three main things that we needed to work on. We have some updates for some of them, unfortunately not for all, but yeah, you will see. First of all, channels, once they are set up, they need to deal with oplock and lease breaks from the SMB protocol level. And there were, at the beginning, some open questions, really a lot of unknowns, how really oplock and lease breaks, which are communications from the server back to the client, how they really can be made multi-channel aware inside of Samba, because right now they're completely unaware. They just consider there's only one TCP connection, and they're not really taking into account that there might be multiple routes to just one session. They're completely ignoring the fact of that. So we needed to work on this and make sure that if one channel fails, that then the server can kind of use other existing paths to a client in order to properly communicate these SMB messages. So this has been mostly done, I'd say. My colleague Sachin can also elaborate on that a little bit more later. But we don't really have the ability to fully test it right now, because as I said, FD passing per se is something we cannot represent in the testing frameworks that we use, which is a socket wrapper in that for that purpose. So some good progress has been made on that front, but it's not fully completed yet. And the last thing, really the aspect of having this very, very comfortable automatic configuration, that, so that nobody actually needs to make conscious decisions what IP is now whatever relevant for which channel and what happens in a cluster if an IP is moving between nodes and these sorts of things. All these things need to live and need to be implemented in CTDB, and this is just unfortunately still a larger to-do, which we hopefully can address soon. Right, first of all, oplock and lease break failures and the missing multi-channel awareness inside of Samba. So what are oplock and lease breaks? I just quoted here the definition from the SMB spec. It's quite obvious that the technology Samba is very familiar with and use it all the time, so we have many tests for this as well. But really the questions that we had when we looked at this was, If you have multiple channels, then is there a specific protocol, specific meaning, which channel to choose when you want to communicate back to a client? Can you just pick a random channel? Is it important to pick just the first one or the one which was last used or something like this? And in particular, also the question, what happens upon channel failure, right?
How recently did you look at the document?
Just yesterday, I realized there's now some
And it still doesn't answer your question? We made this change to
I saw it, yeah.
Okay.
I just really realized that there is some nice documentation now, which kind of fills a gap, because in particular for blocks, there was nothing documented. And we.
A gap, indeed.
Yeah. And I was surprised to find it there. It was because you mentioned this in your talk yesterday. But the funny thing is actually this contradicts with some of our findings. So, but this is something we need to verify one more time, maybe.
Thank you. Just one comment, maybe for those who are not so deep into the protocol issues themselves. So usually the client sends something to the server and the server sends a response, right? And for that, the multi-channel, everything is taken care of in the product with the sequence numbers, etc. But this op-lock and least break is basically the instance where the server is sending something to the client without being a response. So this is why this is a special case. And yeah, it was originally taken care of, and this is how to fix this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's even more insidious than that.
It's even more insidious than that because some of these requests require a response and some don't. Some of them optionally can take a response, and it's kind of wacky. Yeah, I apologize for the protocol, but it's just the way it is.
Right. Okay, so I'm really very happy that we have now documentation about these things, but as I just mentioned, actually our testing has proven that this is not exactly like that. But before really coming back to DocHelp and to saying, oh, maybe this is not the right thing to document, we definitely want to run our tests again and verify this.
So, too.
Yeah.
Not in the document, right?
Right.
In fact, I remember there was one.
Okay, there is one bug.
There is one bug. There's some case in which the server notifies the client and the client doesn't respond. And something really weird happens, but it's a bug in Windows. So,
okay, yeah, that would explain a lot, actually. if that is the case, yeah, very good. Yeah, but at least now with this documentation, we kind of now have something we can diff against and say, okay, no, we can then set the final clarification in the docs as well. Okay, channel failure, we just talked about this, I can skip that. So, because we had all these open questions already a couple of years ago, at the Interop Lab 2016 actually already, so 3 years ago, and then in 2017 we continued that research work, we came up with, at the time, a very chaotic SMB torture test suite that was trying to do all kind of things to provoke all kind of Windows behaviors. Most of this test suite has now been cleaned up, and Sachin will talk about this a little bit more. So we have now at least some good start of a test suite. Of course, running testing failures is always a very difficult thing when it comes to network outages, because how do you simulate that? It's really a tricky thing. And the only good solution that we, or the maybe most easiest thing to come up for this channel failure simulation was basically to really block IP traffic by using IP tables, so a very brutal way to drop packets on the floor and to provoke failover mechanisms on the clients. But it seemed to be working quite good for us. So in the end now we have two test suites, one for op-locks and one for leases. Of course, they're kind of are very similar. And the findings that we had at this I.O. lab 2016 to 2017 was that op-lock break is always sent on the last created channel, while least break is always sent on the first created channel. But we've learned that this is really just implementation behavior, obviously not really something protocol relevant or important. And for oplock breaks, we were observing that there were no retries happening at all once the first connection was failing, while for leases, we observed that then the other channels are just continue to be tried. Yeah. Yeah, so this is probably exactly...
It's just bugs. You know, it's not the intention of the protocol.
Yeah.
The intention of the protocol is the server tries rather hard to notify the client before yanking an op-lock or a lease away, right?
Right.
And it's a bug that we don't retry, and it's a bug that we do. Well, it's not really a bug what channel we select. That's pretty much arbitrary. But, you know, it's a linked list, right? If it's first, yeah. Last, whatever, that kind of thing.
Okay, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Good. Yeah, then just hand over to my colleague, and he will talk a little bit more about this cleanup work that we did in the meantime from last year on, in order to bring these test suites in a more really usable fashion and to bring them upstream.
Yeah, so we cleaned up the SMB torture test for multi-channel. We cleaned up the SMB torture test for oplock and lease break retry, as well as some generic tests were included. These are all pushed upstream, but the automatic testing has not been enabled because we still need the socket wrapper work to be included upstream. The way Samba differs, the code we have in Samba differs from Windows, is the way Windows determines that the oplock break request has been delivered to the client. So Windows seems to rely on the TCP stack completely, wherein if the packets have been delivered to the, wherein when these, the send request, the TCP send request has returned successfully, the server determines that the oplock break or lease break request has been delivered to the client. On Samba, we instead rely on a response being sent back by the server, by the client. Now, this means in Samba we can change the way we test. We do not have to use IP tables. We just in the torture test suite, we just ignore any oplock break request coming in from the server and never send a response back. And that kind of triggers the oplock break or lease break retry on the Samba server. For Windows, because of the way it behaves, we have to use IP tables. The problem with using IP tables is that we need root privileges when you're running the SMB torture test. We also are limited to the Linux, the architecture. So those are the problems. We don't have the same problems in the Samba server because of the way we deal with these, with the way we deal with these failures, or how do we determine if the timeouts have happened. So that's a difference. And Tom, is that fine in the sense the way Samba behaves at the moment?
I can guess based on what you're describing what's going on. The Windows network stack it has the interesting property that a send is completed only when the remote peer acts that data. In most systems, Linux, if you do a send that goes down to TCP, it completes when the data is buffered, not when the data is actually acknowledged, right? So you don't really know anything based on the result of a send. It just says, okay, I got your data, it's on the way. But so Windows gives the server a little more information that yes, the data has actually arrived at the peer. He's acted the data. That doesn't actually say that the server has seen it. But the TCP stack has got it on the remote side, so it's really, really close to the front door. The second part of the discussion is that what I mentioned a moment ago, not all oplock breaks are ACT, right, at the SMB layer. So the server doesn't really know a priori whether this request will receive a response. And therefore, a shortcut is taken, and it says, well, I know I delivered him the message, and I know he's got it. So I'm going to consider it, you know, on its way and delivered. It may not be quite delivered, but it's close. So I admit there's a little bit of a corner being cut. Actually, I honestly think that Samba's behavior is probably more accurate, more strict. The problem is the protocol doesn't always require a reply. So you got some special cases to cover.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's good. One of the advantages of the Samba behavior is we can then run tests, the SMB torture tests against it on non-privileged machines which do not use IP tables as well. So that works well for us. Yeah, we still have some to-dos. We still need to determine what do we do with fail channels. So when we try to do an op-lock or release break, we wait for the timeout. Once the timeout has been achieved and we haven't had a response from the client, we determine that the channel has failed and we mark it as such. But at the moment, the cleanup code to clean out any failed channels do not, we haven't put that in yet, but that should be going in shortly. TCP settings.
Right. These are some things from the observations that we made at the IO lab. There are some socket options that we can set in order to kind of mimic the same behavior with retry patterns and timeouts for individual sends and so forth. So we also need to set up these. You had some other findings for the relationship between timeouts and number of channels.
Yes, that's in a different slide. But also, we had also noticed that op-lock break retries are never actually performed on a Windows machine. So we think that's a bug, but we ran a few tests yesterday. One of the questions I wanted to ask here was what sort of timeouts do we set? On Windows machines, depending on the number of channels set, the timeouts seem to vary. That is per channel. So, for example, on a single channel, it'll wait for about 30 seconds before it determines it's a timeout. When you have two channels, it waits for about 5 seconds before it tries on another channel. When I tested with three channels, it waits for approximately 1 second before it times out and switches on to the next channel and seems to cycle through the channels. I'm not sure how many channels it'll go through eventually, but at that point, the timeout seems to be one second per channel.
It's probably not a timeout. The server's not giving up on that request. It's just saying, well, it's taking a little longer than I might have expected, and I've got more channels. Why don't I just do it on the other channel?
Okay.
Right? So it could receive the reply on the initial thing. It has, the timeout is the 30 seconds you're describing. That's the sort of thing you get when the client fails to respond at all. That's the actual, you know, final, the server's going to give up and give the lease to somebody, the op-lock to somebody else.
Okay, so in this case, it just cycles through all the channels until for the 30-second timeout.
Yeah, I mean, it will cycle through the available channels to perform a retry, if you will. But it hasn't actually timed out yet.
Yeah, okay. At the moment, for our development tree, we try on the first channel. We wait for about 25 seconds for a response.
Oh, that's a long, 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 long.
Yes,
long
so time. I probably need to change that before we push it upstream. Yes.
Yeah.
And also, we retry only once, so probably I need to do a lot more retries on different channels.
I mean, the problem is that an op-lock break that requires this client to flush its cache can take quite a while.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the client's going to be sending the server a whole mess of stuff. It just doesn't happen to be the response to the op-lock break because he's still pushing his dirty pages.
Yeah.
So there are other things you can look at to see if something's happening.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rest of the questions were related to what we just discussed.
Can you go back to the previous slide, please?
That one?
Yeah, this one. So why have you taken off the list the first item? Make sure. I mean, if I got Tom right, yes, he was describing Windows, TCP, send packet behavior there. Where on Windows, the server knows that the TCP packet arrived at the client. And we always had these plans in Samba to implement it in Samba as well. So
Exactly. So that
I think it's a terrible layering violation to look at the TCP ACK. I don't recommend it. Windows
but it's
doesn't,
Windows
but
behavior.
It's my personal opinion as a protocol developer that that's a bad idea. So I'm not going to sit here and recommend you do what Windows does.
All right. So you recommend taking it off the list and like there?
I'll have to think about it before I give you a specific recommendation.
That would be much appreciated.
I don't want to just sit here and say that without thinking.
Yeah. Because I mean, this has given us headaches for years. I think this specific point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Because for that reason, also we were just discussing about this morning whether I should take it out. I remember that we had. I think there is kind of this algorithm there that really looks at the list of Qt packages which are sent to be which are supposed to be sent out but not yet delivered, versus the counter of the kernel who records which packages have been delivered.
Where we have sent an oplog break request and which responses have we received, we look at those.
But
the problem was
we hit
a few bugs, on I noticed a few bugs when we receive responses out of order. So we send an oplog break request to A, an oplog break request to B, but we get the response to B before we get response to oplog A, and then we had a few problems there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm using T-event timers for now, and it seems to work really well with these.
Yeah, okay. Good. Now, the big problem that we also had was for testing. As I mentioned, every commit that really goes to Samba upstream has to go through some CI that's still auto-built, although we have other means now as well, but whatever the official way is still things need to get through auto-built, and inside of auto-built there really all the whole bunch of tests are being run against Samba using a whole set of abstraction libraries, socket wrapper, NSS wrapper, and so forth. All these libraries that Andreas has also made available to the outside world a bit easier. And in socket wrapper, there has never been an implementation of FD parsing available. And that, of course, means that we can't really run multi-channel tests against our own implementation inside of AutoBuild, because there's just no abstraction of FD parsing. There is a hard-coded hack, which we kind of can use for our own development, but this is not something we want to bring upstream, obviously. Now, for this work, there has been some good progress being made by my other colleague, Anoop, and by Michael, and also by Andreas Schneider. They looked into these things, mostly preparing socket wrapper a bit, making it suitable to finally implement FD parsing. So a lot of internal data restructuring has been done, and also pushed and merged upstream. Socket wrapper itself has been made thread safe. That has also been an important work item. Then there has been a memory mapped area made available in order to share the socket space between the processes, all that protected with pthread robust mutexes. So that's all done. Not all of that is pushed, because I think there's still one bug lurking around, which is very tricky to reproduce and not always reproducible, so something we need to still sort out. And then there's still the task of really putting the entire FD parsing into that. There's a good agreement on a plan to do that, and some preparational work being done, but it's just not yet there. So that's currently the state of work of that. And finally, the automatic configuration aspect with CTDB, and CTDB is really the architecture piece that really monitors IP addresses, these sorts of things. There are ways where you can kind of integrate CTDB and multi-channel even today, if you just really take very good configuration measures. So this is not an automatic configuration then, but you can at least make sure that if you use multi-channel with SMBD and with CTDB, you're not running into any potential issues, because there is one potential thing. I will quickly explain it here. So multi-channel works like the client approaching the server. In this case, it's whatever going to IP1 or node 1 and getting the list of interfaces. The client will then respond back with the server will respond back with a list of 3 IPs. All these are potential candidates for a multi-channel setup. So the client will happily establish a session. Now consider that one IP address, one connection, one channel is failing. And the normal behavior of CTDB in that case would be to move that IP address to another node so that all the IP addresses are still available. And what then would happen is that the client would happily connect to that IP 1 on node 2. And obviously, we can't do FD passing between node 1 and node 2, which means that it's completely in a dysfunctional multi-channel setup. So for that reason, CTDB really needs to be either in charge of always taking into account, oh, this could be a set of IP addresses which are part of a multi-channel setup. So I either move them all at once to one node, or I do some other, whatever, grouping of interfaces and these sorts of things. Amitay?
I mean, there is an easier way to prevent failure from happening, and which gives you exactly what you need. So in that case, the IPs will never go to a different node. They will just stick to the same node.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I outlined here on the first slide, which is to use individual public address files per node, basically, right? So then the IP addresses would always be stuck to one node, and there wouldn't be any surprises of IPs migrated, right? Yeah. But in the long run, we want to have a fully integrated solution, of course, with CTDB. And come back to that almost last slide. At last time, XP, we already talked about this, that we maybe could have something like a multi-channel daemon as an architecture component of CTDB, which then also has an interface for querying the list of interfaces that CTDB is taking charge of, so that SMBD can really completely offload all that complexity of IP management out to CTDB, so who's then in charge of doing that. That would, of course, be a very elegant solution, because then I can save more gray hair and put it to CTDB. But I guess we will continue discussing about this. This is something, unfortunately, where we didn't really make a lot of progress last year. Right, and that actually already concludes our update on this. So, documentation. I'm very, very delighted to see that there are many new things documented now for multi-channel and failover with oplocks and list breaks in the official SMB spec. That's wonderful. But there's also really a ton of very good other Microsoft-specific documents about multi-channel. So that's all we can give you an update on. So thank you. Any questions?
That last failure scenario that you described really surprised me, that you'd fail over an IP address. I mean, if node 1, 2, and 3 don't have some sort of cluster relationship with one another, you've just attempted to move all the state from node 1 to node 2 by assigning the IP address to node 2. I mean, it's like, why in the world would you migrate that IP address without having migrated the server state?
The server state, so to say, is already shared because it's using CTDB, so it's present on all the nodes at all time.
Oh, all right. So node 2... Can rebind the session, for instance.
You better. I'm sure, Volker, you can explain it better. Please go ahead.
We're doing multi-channel microphones. Failover. Okay. Well, it strikes me very odd that the IP address would migrate. That's not something that the Windows cluster will do.
All right. Yeah, but Volker has a response.
Just to explain, we need the current architecture is that all TCP connections just have to end up in the same process server side, and that's how we work. And we can't really distribute file handles and credit oplock and whatever state across for the same session across different processes,
right,
and nodes.
It's awkward and horribly inefficient, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh?
Well, to move all that state back and forth between nodes dynamically, right?
Yes, correct. That's the point.
Right.
One more comment.
Yes. Okay.
So
one basically historical comment on that is that CDDB and Samba clustering obviously predated the arrival of clustering and all these newer things in SMB.
The traditional IP address
so
failover model.
Originally, CDDB was just making the whole cluster appear as a single big machine to the unaware SMB client. And that's why now we have features. So first of all, we have clustering with witness and so on. And we have features like multi-channel who actually really required to be on one physical host because of our implementation here and the efficiency things you mentioned. So that's basically how CDDB clustering and SMB3 are a little bit orthogonal to one another. So eventually we might end up, if we have everything implemented, not doing IP failover at all and relying on witness and all these features, and then everything would be clean. But for now, we need CDDB in the cluster. This is a little bit like history.
It's just the granularity of what's being failed over that surprised me. So the SMB way to handle such a failover would be for node 2 to host what's called an asymmetric share and to respond to the client with, you know, I've got your share, but it's much more efficient if you go back to node 1.
We would probably just leave it degraded in this sense and try to prevent migration at all, because we would have to change a lot how CDDB works in this case.
And I will also point out that the client will eventually discover that IP1 is no longer available on node 1 when it sends the query network interface info. But it polls for that. There's no, you know, dynamic shootdown of its cached information. So you've got, you know, a few minutes of suboptimal behavior. Yeah, a little bit awkward. But that's what witness is all about, right? Witness would reach around the corner and say, you know, move.
Mm-hmm.
So, that would be my question. What would be the SMB mechanism, or maybe at the RPC layer with witness, the mechanism to redirect the client from node 2 and tell him, go back to node 1, asymmetric shares?
Yeah, there are a couple of methods in witness that do this. The witness V2 is probably what you want, where it can monitor an address. I mean, that's really what's going on here. And you know, it will say that address is no longer available on node 1, and he'll get a prompt notification of that. But anyway, that's in witness V2. Witness V1 could monitor the server and share name. Witness V2 can also monitor interfaces.
So that's witness. And what about at the SMB protocol level?
There's also
at the SMB protocol level, there's not much. The big one is the redirect. That was introduced in 3.02.
That's the 3.1.1 tree connect?
Was it a 3.1.1? Yeah, there's a new extended error that comes back from the tree connect that says, you know, I know what you're trying to do, but you need to do it over there. That would be the redirect, the tree connect.
Which
redirect.
Clients, which Windows client versions do support this?
Whatever one Windows. Supported that thing when the server started. So I'd have to go look it up. But it's
should
in the
be
document.
Supported.
It's in the document, I'm sure. There's a behavior note that'll say what versions do it. But no, that's not universal. That was introduced partway through. And the tree connect is sort of like, it's kind of like the asymmetric thing, but it's a more, you know, it's a pushed request. There's a flag and a context that's set in the tree connect that says the client is willing to be redirected, and the server can reply with this when that's present. Otherwise, the client's just stupid about it, and the server's going to have to deal with the stupidity, which leads to this inefficient behavior.
Right. There's another question over there, I think. Yeah.
Is there any plan to have the multi-channel working across nodes? Or is that something you really do not want to touch?
You mean that you have clients connected to multiple nodes at the same time? No, not with multi-channel. Not with the current implementation using FD parsing, because it really...
And as long as you are using FD parsing, there's no way to do it, right?
Right. Yeah.
But it will work, provided you configure.
As Gunther mentioned, it will work provided you configure CDDB to not do failover. In that case, multi-channel will just work fine.
But not in a setup like this. So, the question was if it would work in a setup like that. if we could make it work. So,
what's the background of the question? Why do you need that?
Well, failover for one, and getting more performance than OneNote can deliver.
So you say that you need more performance than OneNote can deliver. This means that the network and the client is so much more powerful than your individual nodes.
Yeah.
I think you need to fix that. We should be able on server side to just saturate any network and with a single SMBD. And we as Samba are going more multi-threaded. So, I mean, if you have a single SMBD on a single core on a very low power server machine, yes, but this is not what we can optimize for.
And no, if you have if multiple servers can deliver more performance,
of course you're right, but is it really a requirement for a single individual client to request more performance than a single server can deliver?
Think about 8K playback.
We should be able to do that. I mean, we can easily saturate, or not saturate, but I have seen on 100 gigabit, I have seen 3 gigabyte per second.
Yeah, that's not enough.
Well, then we need to tune that. You need to saturate 100 gigabit with a single stream.
Well, if you have 8K and want to play back stereo and maybe think about 60 hertz instead of 60 frames instead of 30. So
what bandwidths do you need?
There are some crazy requirements sometimes, so
what bandwidths do you need?
More than one node can deliver. So we are working right now on client side with GPFS as a GPFS native client, but it would be cool to have a multi-channel.
Let's talk offline. We'll be able to fix that.
One more comment to that is also that it is a little bit deceiving to assume that just distributing the SMB load that is actually in one session over multiple nodes will automatically result in a higher throughput, because then the nodes need to kind of coordinate for the access to the disk. So that is something that will, again, drop the performance, I guess. So this is why we had to move it into not only a single node, but into a single process, because at this point in the single process, we are coordinating the access to the disk. If you don't do that, then there is a problem. So, I mean, a little bit coordination is needed, so there will be additional cross-node traffic that might just spoil this. Yeah. Not completely impossible eventually, but yeah. Hopefully there are other ways to remedy that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was just an idea. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention that sort of stripe, it's usually handled with striping, is done by other similar protocols, and there's no reason that SMB couldn't support that with a little additional topology information. To my knowledge, there are no commercial SMB servers that support that type of thing, but there are some very similar approaches taken in other SMB layered protocols.
Can you
elaborate on that?
So,
I'm sorry.
Can you explain that a bit more? Is there SMB protocol support for doing what he requires?
There's no native SMB protocol support for it. But layered above SMB, let me cut to the chase. We have a product as part of Windows Server called Storage Spaces Direct that does something much like that. It's used behind Windows servers.
Yeah, but applications would need to be aware of that.
No.
So the application sees a single file handle delivering whatever 20 gigabytes per second.
Correct.
Over a separate backend.
So storage spaces, are you familiar with storage spaces? It allows aggregating multiple physical block devices into a lot. It's kind of like RAID, software RAID, basically. And so a single device object will then manage multiple physical devices. Well, you can layer that on top of SMB, where each SMB connection accesses a separate slice of blocks on multiple devices. They are in turn sent over multiple SMB connections to multiple SMB servers. If you look for storage spaces direct, not just storage spaces, which is the Windows software RAID thing, but storage spaces direct, which is the remote version of it, you'll see lots of pictures of this type of thing. But it's a layer above SMB. It's using SMB as a transport, and it is using this stuff.
I'm sorry, I think we have to stop the discussion here because the time's very much over. Yeah. And I want to give you the chance to get a new coffee before the next speaker starts. Thank you very much. Okay.